Welcome back to Shattering Myths. This time we typically turn to the Torah, as it has transpired over the last few weeks. We have turned our attention to Torah, but teaching in relation to an enormously important prophecy, that prophecy being the one in Yeshayah, Isaiah 17 and 18, where God attributes the decimation of Israel and the all-Islamic war against Israel that is in our immediate future, with the fall of Damascus and the Syrian government, and ties all that into a dire warning for the United States. But we're going to put that on pause a wee bit longer. We have Kevin calling in from Paradise, from Hawaii. Kevin, I can tell you that I have spent a fair amount of time in Israel, and I understand that that's God's favorite place on earth, but right now it's pretty polluted by Islam and rabbinic Judaism and other kinds of things. I'm a whole lot happier when I'm in Hawaii, to tell you the truth. It's about as pretty a place as there is on earth. How are you today?
I'm doing fantastic. I'm a little less prepared than I would like to be, but I'm encouraged continuing to hear other serpent wranglers. And, you know, I love how the exposition, if I can say that, on Paul or Shaul,
yes,
has opened up doors and new arguments for people that I deal with between the Christianity. Rabbinic's roots are that all power was given to Moshe. From that point, they could actually take it. So a Hellenistic Jew, from my understanding, came down, or Yahud, no longer a follower, came down from the Hellenistic regions, predominantly, probably trained, in the Hellen ways, came down and was required to tie one shoe or one sandal in the neck and do all that. Right. That could have been frustrating, I can imagine.
Oh, absolutely. Then, Rabbinic Judaism is an extraordinarily complex set of laws. It's why it takes so many years of schooling to be prepared to elaborate on all of the laws. One of the great examples that Rabbinic Judaism will explain, the reason that the Talmud is necessary, the reason their oral law is necessary, for example, is that Yahweh only tells you what things are not good to eat and what things are good to eat. But the kosher laws that Rabbinic Judaism has put in place are all explained in the Talmud. So their statement is, you wouldn't know how to eat kosher if it wasn't for the Talmud in Rabbinic Judaism, because all God says is these things are good to eat and these things are not good to eat. So they justify their very existence on their elaborate set of rules. It's pretty funny.
So coming from someone who was trained in the Aristotelian ways, which is predominantly Christianity's backing, they all come from that round. Researching into there. So, but at the same time, he was trained in a sense as a Hellen, which included at that time no judgment on the oracles or graces and things along that line over through Athena. So here he is. He's raised in that. And then could you imagine? I mean, most of us, I think, could that have experienced the Hellenism in our own culture. That he goes and he's bound by that nightmare. And then this is what I propose on this, but not the purpose of the call, is that he's walking along this rich young ruler and then he's defaced in public. Now, this is my argument always is to these, if Shaul was, or Apollos came in his real name, which was also his name given through the temple, it appears. It's hard to follow that all the way through, but I believe we can prove that with time. That he walks in and he proposes, I've done all of this right. The same braggadocious we see in his ignorantium arguments. So there he is. He's standing there and before everybody, because this is a culture where everybody shows up for these periods for their own purposes or directed by the serpents. Then he walks in, and it literally is the serpent because the cross with the serpent wrapped around it, which is our medical, is also the symbology that they've always stood by and said that he has no name.
Correct. Correct.
Okay.
All true. And it's interesting, of course, that if you, when you read Paul's letters, even though he makes it, interpreters make it sound like he is opposed to Gnosticism, almost everything he says is Gnostic in its approach.
It's rooted and grounded in Gnosticism.
Oh, of course.
The original serpent. Even the Vedics say that all comes from sexuality or the Karma Sutra, and all knowledge comes from that. And that's exactly what the Gnostics believe. And they've always been trained that way because they encapsulated all of that information that was put together at Alexandria. They didn't burn it. That's what they told the general, the myth. But really what they did was they confiscated it because we know that a librarian had a son in there with a very genius mind. Tesla that came out with the Vedic or the teachings that were developed out of that period right there. So
it's also interesting that Gnosticism was also significantly embraced by the rabbis, and that the Kohala, the Kabbalah, and the Zohar are articulating Gnostic positions, and a lot of that's true because of the Greek influence on the religious establishment of Israel, starting about 200 to 300 BCE, and there was a great revolt. The Maccabean revolt even speaks of this, between which strain of rabbinic Judaism was going to prevail, and ultimately it was the Greek influenced that prevailed. And Gnosticism makes its way in through, and it's a very important part of rabbinic Judaism today with Kabbalah and the Zohar. Now, you mentioned questioning Paul in the 1,200-page book that I've written exposing that Sheol was a false prophet. Well, I do mention in that book that Paul was articulating Gnostic beliefs. I don't make it a significant part of the book because it seemed to be a waste of most readers' times to establish what Gnosticism was, who conceived it, where it's wrong, and then to show how Paul was advancing it. It was much more effective simply to compare what Paul said to what Yahweh and Yahusha said, because if he's contradicting the very God that he claims that he's representing, he must be a liar. And I thought that was sufficient.
Once it's proven as a road less traveled, so to speak, which always ends up being a lot broader than we thought, ends up being a dead end into a viper's pit once again. So I agree with you.
Yes.
You've made sufficient argument to substantiate that, and I'm sure there is plenty of scholars that can back that up. My argument my proposal at this point is, what would cause someone to such critical psychological, if I may, damaged thinking? And I would think this is that someone that was defaced in public before him that wouldn't move towards, but also saw through his argument, right? Which was Yahusha, the diminished manifestation. Thank you. That was a clarity that I appreciated and was hard to argue up till I heard your argumentation on that right there. And, of course, it's rejected with higher level of fighting than anything else in people's trying to support their own fallacies. But the thing that I see right here is, and have questioned and have failed myself to prove, is that was the young rich ruler actually Sha'ul? Because he enraged, could you imagine the madness of being defaced as he was rising through the ranks as this proud young fellow under Gamaliel training? He was the next chosen one, right? And then all of a sudden, he was defaced, and all the people were there watching him. And that would, in my assumption, that would cause him to go into public or private, but begin to go back to his roots and tie them in with the Babylonian religions of the Illuminati or the rabbinical, because it means the same thing.
Yeah, it's true that Paul was exposed as a fraud before he wrote his first letter. The wolf in sheep's clothing is absolutely Shaul. There is no other candidate for the wolf in sheep's clothing, the Torahless one. And Yahweh, in the book of Habakkuk, calls him out by name and calls him the plague of death. So Paul, and even in the in his Olivet discourse, where Yosha is giving his disciples, these are the things I really want you to know. And if anybody claims to have seen me while in the wilderness, it's they're a liar. Do not believe him. And what did Paul claim to have seen him on the road to Damascus in the wilderness? And you even then look at Yosha's statement about how in Ephesus there is there are false apostles, and it's Paul, and he's writing about how he and Timothy were in opposition to Yahochanan there in Ephesus. So he was publicly disgraced there. He was also publicly disgraced in the Jerusalem Council when the disciples brought him in and said, no. You can't condemn the Torah. The Torah is the foundation. And they condemned him publicly. And so he went to war with the disciples. And, you know, ultimately, Paul's last letter to his lover, Timothy, is, I am completely abandoned. I don't have a single person now who is with me, who trusts me, who is on my side. He was, if it hadn't been for Marcion reviving the legend of Paul, no one would even know of him today. He was completely rejected in his own time. And if you look, too, at his letters, his first letter is Galatians, which he writes as a rebuttal to the Jerusalem Council, where he was demeaned and denounced. And you look how angry he is at everybody having rejected. I mean, he begins, he calls everyone foolish and stupid and dead for having rejected his teaching. And then you look at how 1st and 2nd Corinthians and 1st and 2nd Thessalonians do exactly the same thing. They attack the audience as having rejected Paul. So, he's enraged. He was and the people that he talked to didn't believe him. They knew he was full of it. And he, you know, the reason that Paul chose the Gentiles and didn't want to speak to Jews, was that the Gentiles didn't know enough about the Torah to know that Paul was contradicting the very God that he claimed inspired him. So he was playing to ignorance. And even then, the ignorant were smart enough to say, no, we're not buying any of this. Go away. We reject you. We'll be back in a moment. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. We're having a conversation with Kevin, calling in from Hawaii, about evidences that Paul was not only a false prophet, but that Yosha spoke of him in many different ways, and how Paul was just wholly and completely rejected during his own life. Kevin, you know, if you were just to boil down Paul's claim into a simple prospect, it would be as follows. The God who articulated the Torah was an ineffective communicator, and that he was incapable of coming up with a plan that was viable. As a matter of fact, the God who articulated the Torah was mean-spirited, and his intention was to enslave people and to make certain that no one could be saved. And that same God then came to him, Paul, who was, by his own admission, insane, by his own admission, demon-possessed. And he asked this egomaniac to come up with a new plan and then articulate that new plan, one which completely contradicts everything in the old plan, and that you should trust him and his God relative to the new plan. Now, that seems like the most irrational, ignorant proposition in human history. How is it possible that there are 2 billion Christians today that believe that?
Because it's rooted with a little truth. And like Awud said, was the wicked. He always talked about the wicked and the sinner. And the wicked are definitely twisted from the knowledge of good and evil they learned from Babylon. And all the great books, so-called, of the serpent dens that expand throughout the universe, you know, and building up all these manifest temples and starving people on the outside, they always have their symbols that are identical, that have no other image from heaven or below, right? So they always say that he's a liar. And so here we are. He does. To tell a lie is not enough. To tell a big lie with rooted with a little bit of truth always works on humanity better. The Xerxes planet, as I like to call it. The ruler over those that are ignorant and silent. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, in other words, he told them what they wanted to hear. And there was a germ of truth in the lie. There really is a God, and God really did author his Torah. That's pretty much the end of the truth, but that was just enough credibility to give his lie wings, particularly because it's what people wanted to hear. He was saying, where Yahweh was saying, I want you to closely examine and carefully consider my guidance, and I want you to embrace the terms and conditions of the covenant after you've come to know me by observing my Torah and prophets. That requires work. And Paul says, don't need to do any of that. All you need to do is believe in the gospel of grace, and that's it.
Yeah. Yeah. The reasoning is out of here. The only one thing that differentiates us from the other nefesh, and if he can eradicate that. So, sort of deviate from my real purpose, you know, on the call. You know, I love what you did with 119. What a passionate agreement, I think, you know, with the original intent of Dawood to share that, or Yahweh to share that with his kids. Psalms 91 is another one, and I know here at this period of time, we deal with a lot of confusion with the charlatans, with their, you know, obvious, they know what's going on. I love how you dealt with that. They do know what's going on, by the way. I'd like to share that maybe some other time in person, you know, with the family. But really, what you hit on some great argument that really dials it down and puts it up to the plumb line, which is Yahweh's word. If it doesn't fit, it doesn't fit. So throw it out.
Right. Throw it out.
I love it. You know, I love
the
attitude.
Your reference to Psalm 119, it's a, for those who are interested in knowing which Dode, who is David, wrote about the Torah. Psalm 119 is the longest psalm. It is it's based on the 22 letters in the Hebrew alphabet. It ties in beautifully with Yahusha's comment that not a single of the smallest letters nor a stroke of any letter shall be done away with in the Torah, because it systematically goes through how to observe the Torah in alphabetical order, explaining the perspective on how to observe the Torah from each letter that comprises the words in the Torah. 22 letters, 22 stanzas, each with 8 statements. And it is the most brilliantly composed song or literature, I think, available to us today, unlocking the best way to observe, therefore closely examine and carefully consider the Torah. I hope you can stay with us, Kirk, Kevin, because you've mentioned Psalm 91. I have never translated Psalm 91 in any of the writings, but I would certainly like to discuss it with you. We'll be back in a moment. Welcome back to Shannon Remus. We're having a conversation with Kevin, who has called in from Hawaii. And during the last segment, after referencing the 119th Psalm, which for our listeners, we many know that we are systematically reviewing on the Shabbat show, which airs at 7:30 Eastern Daylight Time on Blog Talk Radio. You mentioned the 91st Psalm, which is a name I have not heard in a very long time. If it were not for the 91st Psalm, I would not be here. It is when Yahweh, whose name I did not even know, when I received a call from him, and he said that he wanted someone to expose Islam. And when I heard him ask me this, I said, well, first of all, I'm unqualified, which doesn't faze Yahweh at all. In fact, I think the first thing he always likes to hear from people is from them to admit they're not qualified. But I said, Salman Rushdie, it was, at the time, was just now being hounded around the world for having written satanic verses. I said, okay, they kill people who do that sort of thing. Why on earth would I want to go off and expose Islam? And I said, well, you know, I'm open to negotiation. What would you like in return? And I had my my list, and one was, well, I want my family protected if we're going to go off and do this together. And he said, I want you to read the following. It was Psalm 91. I have a tendency, Kevin, and this may also be true for you, when I read the Proverbs and the Psalms, I read them in first person. I view that what God has inspired, it might be, in this case, it was Dode who was speaking, and I think he is speaking regarding Yahusha. But when I read it, I read it in first person, like with the 119th Psalm where Dode, David, is making all of these wonderful assertions regarding the Torah. I look at it as I read the words where I'm reading them in first person, and they become my desire. I chose to read the 91st Psalm as it was presented to me in first person. And in it, Yahweh says that, you know, if you come to know my name, if you come to love and trust who I am and what I am offering, I'll protect your home. I will protect you. I'll work with you. We will accomplish the mission together. And it is just so incredibly enabling. It's the one thing that takes fear out of any mission. I mean, there's no mission I could have done more dangerous than writing Tea with Terrace and Prophet of Doom and then doing 2,500 to 3,000 hours of talk radio interviews denouncing Islam and doing so in my own name. And I do this show under an alias, but I didn't write that book under an alias. I did so in my own name. Single most deadly thing you can do today. And yet, Yahweh stayed true to every one of the promises in Psalm 91. So when you reference it, boy, I tell you, that is near and dear to my heart. What's your impression of Psalm 91? Why did you reference it at this time? How does it speak to you? Well, for some reason, we seem to have lost...
I apologize. I muted out just so there would be no background noise. I apologize.
Okay. Okay.
Well, what I hear from some of the questions that have been coming into the program, and, you know, it's just natural inclination. I look at maybe a story to look back on is when David is willing to keep his integrity with Yahweh, who had already presented himself to him as what he's going to do in his life. And he wanted to maintain that integrity, so he and a number of others ended up in a cave, like most of us in the family. And I include all of us because of the fact that we're all seeking him, not necessarily truth, but what he had to say, because that is true.
Yes.
He is existence without his words. Or in Hawaii, they say aloha. Well, that word, even the pictograph, really represents the breath of life.
Right.
And it's interesting that right now most people are looking for more of that than the argument. There are so many argumentation that don't make sense, and people are trained to really believe that. Our society in general is, or otherwise it wouldn't be a broad path.
Right.
It's an amalgamation of the East, the West coming together as we see the East and West beginning to trouble both on the currency markets as well as on the battle fronts.
Yes. So people are amazingly vulnerable to deception today. It's almost as if awash in information, we have precluded understanding. And that the very tools that are used, logic and rhetoric, that can help transition from knowing to understanding, that they have been abrogated. It's amazing today just how difficult it is for most people to think, to reason, to be discerning, to be judgmental. I'm very concerned about this generation.
So what we do have is his word of for everyone to, I love how you said, okay, I've proven him enough. I don't really need to do any more for the sake of realizing who he is and what he is. We recognize that. Now, to turn ourselves, I just think, what was Dalit doing in those cases? What they were doing with Shamar, they were observing the words of the Father who never lies. He said, I am one. It was St. Valentine, or Satan's child Valentine, that we celebrate today, that brought in the little graces and things along that line with their, poison or mercurical or pharmaceutical weapons. That's what they would do, where we get the word pharmacy or mercury. Right, and of course he was Hermes' twin in the next amalgamation cult. But what we do have is this situation where, what does the family do then? So what the family does is continue to observe his word and see great things of earth. And that was really the purpose of my call, is to add to or take away anything that your mission or your purpose on life, you know, in this existence, and your team. I mean, I don't want to leave out, I love the argumentation that's coming on, and you get the serpent wranglers on there, and we're just stirring up that den of thieves, and people are already saying the sheeple, as they've been trained, or hoodwinked, and all of those books, all of those serpent books are written by the same illumined or rabbi individual, oddly enough. Yeah, you even said that effect on the writings of this tribe of crazy, you know, maniacs that is trying to get there, and they're used, and they have been used as mercenaries to go in, and they believe, but they're way off course from what their original teachings were, even as these other writings. So amalgamation of religions is just what suits the strategy of the day.
Yes, correct. Most of what we do as part of this program and as part of the books is to draw people's attention to what Yahweh had to say and then encourage people to think about it. To the greatest extent possible, we try to provide the tools to help people understand what God said and the proper perspective from which to consider his words. And so you do have to get into some detail. There's some background that is involved just to shamar Yahweh's testimony. Shamar means to observe, to closely examine and carefully consider. There are some things that are helpful. You know, we go into Hebrew grammar here, and we talk about the eternal nature of the verbs in Hebrew and how they are so different than other languages, the stems and the relational nature of these verbs, and how most of the moods convey volition. It's a powerful communication medium that Yahweh has provided, and it is the ultimate antidote for everything that is corrupting the world. And I think that's your primary point, is that if we closely examine and carefully consider what Yahweh had to say to us in his Torah and prophets and Psalms, then we ultimately become immune to. We are no longer susceptible to all of the very popular but extraordinarily pernicious religious and political myths that are destroying the mindset, the attitude, the lives of so many people around the world.
Couldn't have said it better.
Yeah. Well, we're in complete agreement there. It's Yahweh's statement as well. And hopefully this program, that the purpose of the program is to encourage people to consider what God had to say. And the reason we spend the first hour discussing religion and politics and militarism and economic schemes and the media is because the first thing that God says, if you want to come to know me, if you want to establish a relationship with me, the first thing you need to do is to let go of politics and religion, of the things of Babylon. You've mentioned it several times in this call. Unless you're willing to walk away from that gunk, we're not going to have a relationship together. I'm just not going to deal with that in your lives. And so we talk about those things to discredit them so that more people will consider relinquishing their patriotism, their politics, their religion. And that puts them finally in the position where they are prepared from an attitude point of view, from a perspective point of view, to consider what God has to say. And my concern is that if we didn't do that, for example, this caller we had earlier, which was a beautiful presentation of a fictitious argument, If you haven't walked away from religion, you're not in a position to understand who Yahusha is, what he said, what Yahweh said, how it relates, how the two are tied together, and you end up, you know, writing the kind of nonsense this religious fellow did.
Yeah. Abram did, and he was rewarded with life as a result.
Yeah, and if you look at Abram, the thing I like about him is a little different than Dode. Dode was brilliant. Abram was not. You know, Abraham was not the smartest guy in the world. He really had a tough time understanding what God was offering him, and he was stumbling all over himself in trying to get to the place that Yahweh hoped he would go. And Yahweh was very patient with him, in spite of the fact he wasn't the sharpest guy in the world. And I appreciate that, because what God is saying in this covenant relationship, you don't have to be brilliant to appreciate what I'm offering, to be willing to come to know me, or to capitalize on what I'm offering. It's about your attitude, and that was really what worked with Abram. God asked him to walk away from Babylon, he did. God asked him to walk with him, he did. He asked him to embrace these conditions of the covenant, he did. And it took an ongoing relationship and time that they invested together to get him in that spot. I think it's brilliant that God chose not the smartest guy in the world to share the covenant, and then the smartest guy in the world to share the Torah. We'll be back in a moment. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. I do want to share the seventh statement of the seventh chapter of Yahshayah, because it is relevant to what we have been discussing with Kevin. Speaking of the relatively few that are harvested immediately after the time that Yisrael is thinned at the waist, and immediately before the carnage of World War III begins, with Muslims flooding into Israel by the tens of millions, perhaps as many as 150 million Muslims entering the great jihad against Israel. Speaking of the difference between what exists on earth at this time and at that time compared to heaven, Yahweh reveals in that specific day, this man, he's speaking of one of the 7,000 who is saved by him prior to the beginning of the tribulation war. This man will genuinely regard and always accept the Almighty, his maker. And his eyes will continuously look toward the set apart one of Yisrael. He then says, so then he shall never gaze upon or accept the altars, these works representing what fingers have made. They will not focus on the Asherah, nor worship the sun god images. God is not telling us this on behalf of the 7,000 that he has harvested at this time, that he has brought home, because this documentation isn't going to be of any value to them at this point. They're already in the proximity of Yahweh. He is telling this to those who are left behind, to those who remain. And he's telling them, the difference between my children in the covenant and you is you're religious, and those who are saved are not. You're fixated on Jesus, on Muhammad, on Allah, on whomever it may be, and those who have been saved are focused on Yahweh as their Heavenly Father. It is this stunning contrast. And Kevin, as you talked about the religious malfeasance, Asherah is born and bred in Babylon. And she is the Mother Earth goddess, the Queen of Heaven, the Mother Earth goddess that really is the basis of modern Mother Nature worship through environmentalism, and then the basis of the Madonna and Child, the Queen of Heaven, the Mother of God in Christianity, born directly out of Babylon. And it's the festivals of Asherah that Christians celebrate today, Sunday worship, Easter, Christmas, Lent, all of this comes from Asherah, and almost every aspect of Christianity is a manifestation of the worship of pagan sun gods. Yep. Even, you know, right down to the Christian cross, the Christian steeple, the term church, it's a dying and resurrected God. It's the Trinity. All of it is part of the Babylonian pagan mythology that has been swallowed up as if it's a truthful new religion.
Right. Like he needed a new thing to say, as if he whose words live forever, he needed something else to say. He couldn't speak once for himself. He had to have others to support, scribes and Pharisees.
The root of religion is people trying to make up their own plan, not willing to consider God's plan. But, you know, imagine being God and having articulated, this is my plan. I'm not going to change it. I am going to not only talk the talk, but walk the walk. I'm going to lead you down this path. I'm going to go pay the toll on this path because this is the perfect plan. It is ideal for you. And then to have all these people claim to represent him and say, no, don't go down that path. Go down this other direction that I want to lead. And then people say, well, how could God, why would God ever judge me if I trusted this fellow that led in the opposite direction? But you ever?
We're at that point where we're entering that gate right now, once again, and people are trying to resolve, well, do I hold on to what's proven to be a lie? And the answer is we've been trained to not think. We've been trained to follow the faith of the fathers. Well, look at the fathers. The fathers, if you really drill into the roots of them, which is what he always talked about, you're going to find that it's corrupt from beginning to end, and it follows money. Denomination is a root word in Babylonian methodology of making money.
It's like the coexist bumper sticker. You're going to accept mutually exclusive adversarial claims and embrace them all as if they all were acceptable. We have lost the ability to be discerning, to exercise good judgment, and therefore most people have precluded themselves the opportunity of knowing God or relating to him. We'll be back tomorrow. May God bless.